Okay, so I'm going to try and bridge the gap between Harvey's talk and Peter's talk, which follows the break. So I'm going to spend the first probably a little more than half of the talk talking about normal white dwarfs from this deep exposure that Harvey's done. And then I'm going to switch tack and talk a little bit about low-mass white dwarfs in 6397, because those are also of interest. And so the M4 is built on sort of Harvey's long-running program that dates back to 95, covered by these papers, and then culminating in the two papers we just had. I guess not culminating, it's supposed to be working on larger ones. Then I'm going to talk about some stuff I did with Vicky, Fred, and I guess Eric Fall as well, who decided eventually that he didn't want to spend too much time on this, so he's no longer on the paper. But it was inspired by Adrian Cool, Josh Grindley, and collaborators who found some interesting sources in the Kalamangu diagram of NGC 6397 when they were looking for cataclysmic variables and found a few things that weren't that. Okay, so the M4 white dwarfs. Harvey's described in some detail the proper motion cuts and how we might get these white dwarfs. I'm going to talk about sort of ongoing analysis of that. The paper that we wrote, we had basically a cut of a displacement of half a pixel around the centroid of the cluster motion. In reality, if you're going to start talking about the white dwarf sample, you should probably expect that your ability to centroid will get worse and worse as you go to fainter and fainter. So you might want to make your proper motion displacement cut something that is magnitude dependent. So that's what I've done here. If you plot the proper motion, or the proper motion displacement really, relative to the frame defined by the bright stars in M4, and you plot that as a function of magnitude, so this is basically, Harvey showed the full 2D, if you just now project that out into a one-dimensional distribution. These are the things that are stars, so I've also taken advantage of Jason Calarai's classification of the various objects by their stellarity, so these are clearly stars. On the right here, I actually show things that are clearly not stars as the open circles, and then crosses, which are things which may or may not be there in between. And so parenthetically, Ivan and Harvey have mentioned this business about using galaxies or quasars. So you can see up at the bright end here, you've got a nice frame that's defined. This is literally just fitting by eye, so it shouldn't be taken too quantitatively. But you can clearly see that this extragalactic reference frame is different from the center of the bulge. And so this is where you get these various shifts. I think we're all consistent, and also consistent with the radio measurements of Sagittarius stars' motion relative to background quasars. But anyway, this is the proper motion cut I'd used as a function of magnitude, so allowing for the fact that the dispersion in proper motion of the white dwarfs gets worse as you get fainter. So the previous one was at 0.5, so it's not a major difference. I mean, it would have come up at about there, but just to be clear. And that's the resulting color magnitude diagram. I think everyone's probably sick of seeing this by now. Relative to the questions about massive white dwarfs, this could be a massive white dwarf. So this is, if you were going to find massive white dwarfs, this would be their cooling track. The radii of white dwarf scales inversely with their mass, so more massive white dwarfs will be fainter at a fixed temperature or color. Similarly, brighter ones will be, well, low-mass ones will be brighter. So this is potentially a massive white dwarf, in which case something weird had to happen. For instance, perhaps it's been created by a merger of two lower-mass guys more recently, but as you can see, there's not a whole lot. That's the luminosity function that you get. So Harvey mentioned the fact that this is a burst luminosity function. What I mean by that, or what he means by that, or both mean by that, is that there's this large jump in the luminosity function here, which if you try and model this as a constant star formation rate population, so stars which have a constant offset, you get a much shallower or slower rise in the luminosity function about here. And that's basically just the fact that you have white, you have now an extra parameter to integrate over the offset of the star's birth from t equals zero. Tail where? This. Ah, so this is, I was going to come to this later, but sure, we can talk about it now. So, yes, none of my models fit this little bump here. This, all the models come nicely and monotonically through here. This, the most interesting interpretation of this is some signature of mass segregation. Because on short time scales, on sort of a relaxation time scale or two, the density profile of the white dwarfs should reflect not their masses, but those of their progenitors. And on several relaxation times, of course, they will then go to the point where they're reflecting their own masses. And this turns out to be timescales like 10 to the 8 years cooling time. So that could very well be a mass segregation effect. Okay. There's probably a more mundane explanation, but that's the nice one. Okay, so if you want to get ages out of that luminosity function, you want to treat several things. You want to include your cooling models. You want a main sequence white dwarf mass relation, and I think this is, I've never been at a meeting, including white dwarf meetings, where I've heard the main sequence to white dwarf mass relation discussed as much. So that's encouraging. But so you need that. That's important. You need an IMF, or actually really a PDMF, I guess. I'm being sloppy there. And stellar models to get the ages. It's important to realize M4 has a fair amount of extinction. Roughly 1.5 magnitudes in the visual passbands, and since I'm actually calculating models, the colors from white dwarf models, which involve fully non-gray atmospheres, I didn't want to just throw in a simple extinction correction. So we actually went through the fairly laborious, well, not laborious process, but the process of taking the white dwarf atmospheres, running them through models for the HSD bandpasses. So here we have 55, 606, and 814, and also through some transmission function associated with the extinction law that we think applies along this line of sight, which is actually, I should point out, slightly non-standard. So an R parameter of 3.1 is standard when you're doing reddening, but people infer 3.8 for this particular line of sight, so we've used 3.8. So when I talk about the colors, I'm not just throwing in arbitrary extinction corrections, I'm actually running them through what we think a good transmission function is. And the reason I'm being paranoid about this is because when you get to sort of fairly, when white dwarfs get fairly cool and you start getting molecular hydrogen absorption in the infrared, they start to get colors which do not are not reflected in standard stellar atmosphere libraries, which is what people generally use when they determine these empirical corrections. So you, when you've got a sort of a weird-looking object, you really want to try and do your colors correctly. Okay. Now I jumped ahead, and so I'm lost. Okay. Right. So we should discuss a little bit about what that jump in the luminosity function is from. So here I have a white dwarf cooling sequence with a cooling model overlaid. And on the left, I have luminosity as a function of time, so for the same cooling model. I've noted two important epochs in the star's life here. One is crystallization. That's because the white dwarfs, as they cool, the density and the degeneracy in the center goes up. And at some point, that's enough that the ionic lattice, which is essentially the repository of the star's heat energy, starts to crystallize. So the heat capacity changes, and the white dwarf actually has to spend a little more time getting rid of some energy because it can't actually retain as much energy as it gets cooler when it enters the Debye regime and its heat capacity starts to drop as T cubed. There's a second, and so these two, that effect is important because beyond this point, it starts to make the cooling of an individual white dwarf quite mass dependent, because more massive white dwarfs have higher central densities, they reach crystallization earlier, they reach this point of Debye cooling earlier, and they start to, that's actually what gives us a lot of the age discrimination in this method, is the fact that it makes white dwarf cooling mass dependent. For the purposes of discussing this jump in the luminosity function, it's actually this feature that's important. So you've got your white dwarfs cooling, and at some point there's a bit of a plateau, and this is a logarithmic scale. And the plateau means that if you've got a whole range of white dwarfs, you're now starting to get them piling up in the magnitude bin appropriate to this luminosity, and you'll see that happens to be right before you see the jump in the number of stars here. And this comes about because of the fact that the white dwarf atmosphere is decreasing in temperature, and at some point you reach temperatures of about below about 6,000 or 7,000 Kelvin, and the boundary condition begins to change. And so, since no theorists have actually used the blackboard, let me actually use the blackboard and show you. Up. Yes. Makes sense. Okay, so no white chalk. Okay. So if you think about the white dwarf stellar model, temperature as a function of pressure. When white dwarfs get cool, their internal profiles basically look like this. So they have most of the mass resides in the deep interior, where it's essentially isothermal, maintained by the high conductivity of degenerate electrons. And in the outer parts, it's convective. And at about 7,000 or 8,000 Kelvin, so when white dwarfs are hotter, there's some region in here which is radiative. As the white dwarfs continue to cool, the base of the convective envelope, convection zone, continues to march into the star, and at some point it wipes out this radiative zone. It reaches the edge of the conducting interior. And once that happens, it makes the white dwarf extremely sensitive to the treatment of the boundary condition, because you've no longer got any freedom to play with the internal structure. When you have a radiative zone, there's some opacity, there's some slop in the temperature profile. Now you've got isothermal matched to convective, which is essentially set by the equation of state. So as you change this point, you're going to change this point. Everything moves in lockstep. And when you reach about 6,000 or 7,000 Kelvin, the hydrogen in your atmosphere is going from ionized to atomic to molecular. So the opacity is decreasing. And as the opacity decreases, then remember, if you take your equation of static, your equation of hydrostatic equilibrium, but cast it in terms of optical depth rather than traditionally radius, it goes inversely to the opacity. So this starts to march in at a fairly sharp slope. If you maintain the same shape for your cooling profile, you're now covering a certain range in effective temperature, but because of the slope of this change, you've got to cover a much larger range in central temperature, which is actually what determines your internal clock of your star. And so it's this effect which causes this plateau, this slowing down of the cooling, because you've basically got to get rid of all that internal energy just to get through this narrow range in effective temperature. And that's what's giving you this huge jump in the luminosity function. Okay, and beyond that point, so this is the nice thing. So you've got this jump that occurs roughly at a fixed effective temperature, because it's driven by this boundary condition. And beyond that point, nearly everything is crystallized, so it's nice and mass dependent. And so you actually get some leverage on the age, at least on the models, which include the age. And so it's basically this approach, using the models based on this physics and comparing to the luminosity function that we use. I should also mention, of course, since we're dealing with data, there is a certain incompleteness involved here. So this is the incompleteness from artificial star tests. The open circles are if you actually found the artificial star, no matter where it was. The filled circles are when you actually only use things that you found within half a magnitude of their true magnitude, because this is in fact how we're going to bin them. So this is the guys we use. You'll notice here we're just below 50%. So I will present results that use this bin, but not this bin, and then also results that don't use either of those two bins, just to show you that we have a fairly robust result. Okay. One other thing to mention: there is some things to play with here. So you have. If you want to fit your white dwarf cooling model to the upper part of the main sequence, you have three things to play with. You have the distance, you have the extinction, and you also have the white dwarf mass, since the white dwarf mass scales as radius. So you can play those things off against one another. And so this is just to indicate that there is some flop to playing with the difference between the mass the distance and the extinction in the sense that this is using the same distance but trading off extinction versus mass to fit the upper part, and you see that does give you some difference in how you do things at the bottom. But this is also nice because it gives you there's some leverage between fitting the upper part of the main sequence, white dwarf sequence, and the lower part of the white dwarf sequence, in the sense that given a choice of parameters to fit up here, that then implies certain things about the cooling down this region, and so different choices of parameters give you different results. Okay, so doing that, we can provide various fits. So here are some. I had a better one. This is. Let me see. Here we go. So here is our best fit, basically, to start with, and that indicates. So the observed luminosity function is obviously one of the error bars. These are just Poisson error bars. We fit over this range using these bins, and so this is an excellent. This is a chi-squared per degree of freedom less than one, as you can imagine, because it's running through the data points. We don't fit this guy because of the incompleteness fraction is terrible, and I'm not fitting these guys because A, it's only like 10 to the 8 years. It's fairly insignificant as far as it's completely insignificant as far as the global age, and but there might be something interesting there. It might be binaries, it might be relaxation effects. And you can see from this other plot, you can try different ages. So 11 gigayears gives you a much larger peak. 14 gigayears also gives you a different shape. So the shape is definitely sensitive to how you choose the age. Although, but remember, I'm choosing several different parameters here. Right? I have a fixed set of cooling models. I'm choosing the age, the mass function slope above the turnoff, and also I guess the mass white dwarf radius relation. And I'm going to discuss variations of those things in a second. Here, for instance, now. Given the fixing those other parameters, you can just here's sort of the chi-squared fit as a function of age, and so you can see, so that the solid points are using all except the last, so using that one that's just about 50% complete, and here are the 1, 2, and 3 sigma error bars, so you see you get a very restrictive measurement, sort of 12 to 13 and a bit gigayears. When I first started doing this, I thought this was just too good to be true. And I'm still a little incredulous, but I'm getting more used to it because it does seem to hold up. Part of the reason for being so surprised was that I was used, before I started working on this, to trying to fit the white dwarf sample from the field, which is derived from proper motion surveys. You have 2 or 3 objects in the last few bins. The densities are determined by Vmax corrections, essentially. It's really nasty to try and do that in any statistically self-consistent way. This has just been a pleasure to work with because it's Poisson statistics, right? They're all in the same place. So the observations, the statistical treatments are fine. It's just are straightforward. It's just the theoretical details that have to be dealt with. And so here, this is with the full data set. If you are worried about that 50% completeness bin, you can throw it out, and you get the open circles, and you still get a very good age fit. So I don't think that's much of a worry. Okay. Now, just to be clear, so here are some of the inputs. So we used the cooling models that I wrote in 1999, so well before this proposal. I'm currently working with a student on generating or doing a fit with a variety of models to see how much the model systematics affect things. I used the main sequence to white dwarf relation from Matt Wood, because this is basically the standard that people use. There are several variations, and it actually doesn't make a whole lot of difference. I've used the mass main sequence ages as a function of mass from Jared Hurley. The distance and extinction from Harvey, although I will play with that a bit in a second. I've used, at least for the default models, I've used this X. Remember, I use X, Harvey uses alpha, so add 1 if you want to compare to what Harvey was doing. used the pure hydrogen atmospheres from my models as well. Harvey mentioned hydrogen and helium atmospheres, and in the in the paper that we wrote a couple of months ago, we were careful to do the model fit both hydrogen and helium. I should point out I'm usually the only theorist that really thinks this is worth worrying about. Most people, even if they do helium atmospheres for radiative transfer, assume hydrogen atmospheres as far as cooling is concerned. The reason for that is it makes a big difference if you assume that the atmosphere really is helium, because the opacity is very different. It's much lower, and so as the trend, the jump in the pressure at the photosphere for the helium atmosphere cooling models is much larger, and it affects the cooling quite a bit. And it turns out it's more or less irrelevant. Helium atmospheres are more or less irrelevant for a burst population of 12 gigayears old, because it just doesn't fit. For instance, if you assume that there are no hydrogen atmospheres, they're just pure helium atmospheres, there's no way you get an even remotely acceptable fit. Because you just don't get that jump due to the burst. Don't get that jump due to the fact that you've got this recombination of molecular hydrogen. In the atmospheres. And also at 12 gigayears old, the ones that were helium atmospheres have cooled so far that it really doesn't matter. So from henceforth, I'll just assume pure hydrogen atmospheres. If you're really worried about the helium atmospheres, you can come and talk to me. I can show you those ad nauseum. So 3 sigma age range with the default models, we get sort of 12 to 13 and 13.4 at 3 sigma. if one throws out that last bin, doesn't change things a whole lot. So given that these models fit so well, you can start playing with other things. Like, for instance, say you don't believe the distance. Well, you can do a 2D fit, and you can let the distance float. And so that's what I've done here. So you take that data, you let the distance float, you keep the extinction the same. If the distance floats, let the age float, and your 3 sigma contours come out to be this. The subdwarf distance goes right through the middle, so it's a very nice fit. And you get no significant age variation. You get a distance determination that's actually very competitive with other methods. Instead, if you keep the distance fixed, since people have claimed to have measured it, you can let the mass function slope float. And so you can do the same thing there. That turns out to have a slightly different contour, but again, the age variation doesn't get below 12, and x, Harvey's x was somewhere in here, I think, right? If you take one off of his value. Now, this, the x as determined here is literally just using the white dwarf, so it's basically the power law from which you draw the progenitors of the white dwarfs. But we actually have main sequence stars, right? So you can ask if you can do better constraints by comparing the number of white dwarfs to the number of main sequence stars, kind of like Harvey did, although I'm going to do two different things. So the first one is, let's say I just don't believe these models. I don't want to try and fit those lower main sequence models. Then what can you do? Well, you have, at the upper end, the models do seem to fit. So let's believe that we can actually, at our saturation limit, we can assign an appropriate mass based on the models to that magnitude. Then we can just count the number of things below that, and that number, if you down to, so from 0.53 to 0.086, just the number of white dwarfs, or number of lower main sequence stars gives you a constraint on the x. And you can do the same thing from 8 to 0.8 for the white dwarfs, and you get a number, which is what you can then constrain from the observed number of white dwarfs, 383, and the number of main sequence stars, 585. Now, I've done no completeness corrections for this because, I will show you, so if you do that, you get, so that function I showed you is this, and the observed one for M4 is this. So if we're incomplete for M4 white dwarfs, it's just going to go up. So x will just be smaller. So think of this x as an upper limit. So that's number one here. So if you get that, if you use that constraint on x, it's pretty consistent with just consistent with the contours that I derived from the white dwarfs alone, right? But you can do a second thing. Let's say you actually believe the fit that Harvey did. Then you actually know what the mass function slope is on the main sequence, but you don't just extrapolate that to Halangarn in the white dwarf region. So I'll take that up to the turnoff, and I will enforce continuity, but then the slope above the turnoff is allowed to float. That's what the X means in option two. And so you can do the same exercise comparing to this, and exactly the same. So then it's function two here. So exactly the same thing applies, comparing to the observations, since we are probably missing white dwarfs, it's an upper limit. And in that case, And then it runs right through the middle. So these are in some sense just exercises, and we have to argue about what they represent in terms of present day versus initial mass function. But certainly, it seems perfectly consistent with doing just the total numbers of white dwarfs relative to main sequence stars and the distribution of masses amongst the white dwarfs. So one other thing. So when I showed this that plot of the distance constraint to Mike Rich, he said, "Oh well, can we use this as a distance indicator?" So here's, of course, you can't do this kind of analysis for anything other than M4 and 6397, because then you maybe 6752, if you stick, but the rest of the classes are just way too far away. However, they are the distance constraint to some extent is a function of the jump, the luminosity function jump, right? That's a feature in that luminosity function, and that's a lot brighter than the 30th magnitude that we wanted to go to. So you can ask, well, let's just say you want to hit that jump. You don't really care about getting the age per se. You're going to trust that when people claim that the age is all within 1 giga-year, and we've done it for M4, let's say we just want to hit that that jump. Well, for M4, I can just say, well, let's just throw out everything, the 1.5 magnitudes of the data, and just try and do the same fit, same distance constraint, down to 20, using the data down to 27.5. And so again, you get a pretty good distance fit, assuming 12.5 giga-years, keeping that fixed, but just letting the chi-squared now reflect the various distances that you've chosen. So, I mean, this is just something that was done on Friday, and so we have to think about this a little bit more, but maybe this could be used as a distance constraint. And the last thing on, before I go spend a couple of minutes talking about the helium white dwarfs, is the constraining the burst nature of the globular cluster. So, I mean, so you can think about, well, how, I mean, given that we get such a good fit for the luminosity function, can we actually, and I've made all this noise about being a burst rather than a constant star formation rate, can you actually constrain the width of the epoch? So just as a toy model, let's draw some offset from t equals zero for each white dwarf, distributed exponentially with some time constant t0, and then we can fit over age and t0. And if you do that, you get this. So these again, 1, 2, 3 sigma contours, and so you're constraining the age to be about roughly less than one, or t0 to be roughly less than 1 giga-year. The approximately linear correlation between the best fit age and t0 is pretty obvious, right? Because if you're assigning an offset from some distribution, the mean is not going to be zero, it's going to be some offset from t equals zero. And so there's roughly a linear correlation here. But certainly, large offsets are constrained. So how much time do I actually have for the zero? Okay. I'll stop there. That's half the talk. So. Yeah, we'll see how things go. Yeah. Okay.
After seeing all the mass segregation in the stellar parts, and now seeing the white dwarfs. I mean, Simon corrected me when I was claiming that the white dwarfs wouldn't necessarily, that the white dwarfs would sink because of their relation to the mean mass. But if it's really true that there's as much mass segregation and the average stellar mass is one in the interior, namely the turnoff mass, can you just talk a little bit about, or maybe someone else should, how these results do or don't tell us something about mass segregation? I mean, you're presuming 0.6. When you're saying the distance...
Well, I'm not presuming 0.6 for all of it. No. There's a range of masses drawn from the main sequence to final mass relation. So these are not all 0.6. However, the ones that are 0.8, 0.9, one side of mass, have cooled beyond the point where we're complete. So we just don't see those guys.
So you're sensitive only to...
0.7 plus a little bit.
Okay.
At least in these models.
Question for you and Harvey. What was the slope of the mass function for the field stars in M4? Harvey mentioned that you measured it for the stars between the white dwarf sequence and the main sequence. I was wondering whether that came out as shallow as x equals zero, or whether that was...
That might be for Mike Rich. The problem with doing that for the field stars is that we have a population we don't understand. So if you think it's all... in a halo, then there should be roughly the same metallicity as M4. But there's a population, and there are some that look like that. But maybe 20 or 30% of the population are redder at a fixed magnitude.
So you've got a distance metallicity degeneracy.
Well, yeah, we don't know. Are these things more distant or more? They don't show the kinematics that you might expect if they were really foreground disk objects. So we're playing with ideas, but until you can split those two up, it's not clear how you want to assign them to a mass, which mass luminosity relation you want to assign it to.
And the other thing I was going to ask is, what were you going to say next?
Well, okay, I'll try and hit the highlights, shall we? So this is just the point that so Adrian, Josh, and collaborators found several objects between the white dwarf sequence and the main sequence in the core of 6397, and they were looking for CVs, and these were kind of the right things for CVs, but A, they didn't flicker, so they didn't appear to be having any accretion, and B, if you looked in sort of the eye in the red, they showed no evidence for a companion, which usually CVs shift back if you look in the redder colors. And so they have hypothesized that these were low mass helium core white dwarfs. And so we went after the implications of these. And so this shows just, for instance, they are both low mass, so they're sort of less than 0.25 solar masses, actually less than 0.2, and they're young, 10 to 7, 10 to the 8 years. There is some degeneracy. There's a problem in that for very low mass white dwarfs, the ages are somewhat affected by how much hydrogen you stick on the surface, because you can actually supply some of the luminosity from hydrogen burning at a low level. But if you actually, so I won't go through the whole business shebang about how we did that, but you can actually put constraints on that dynamically, in the sense that if you believe these are from stable mass transfer, then from all the work about orbital period mass relations, white dwarf mass implies an orbital period, and you can ask, well, what is the lifetime of that binary? And that puts some significant constraints, because they're sitting right in the core of 6397. And because they're low mass and they're in the core, they are inferred, as Josh and Adrian did, to have low mass companions, dark companions, so either neutron stars or white dwarfs. And to make a long story short, since I have to, you can't actually make a white dwarf system like this in the core that survives for a significant length of time by stable mass transfer, because the orbital period mass relation just says your binary is too wide, it gets affected by exchange interactions, it gets broken up, and the little white dwarf will get thrown out since it's low mass. So you've got to make it by an unstable mass transfer. If it's going to be unstable mass transfer, you have to meet the conditions in the progenitor system for unstable mass transfer, and you can't do that with a neutron star companion because it's 1.4 solar masses. And so then if you have, for unstable mass transfer, you basically got to have the donor star be comparable or more massive than the accretor. 1.4 solar mass main sequence stars, went out of fashion 5 gig years ago in globular clusters, right? So you've got to have something less than that. So you can't do it with a 1.4 solar mass accretor. You've got to do it with a 0.6 solar mass accretor, which you could have quite happily do. So we would predict that these... actually, we did predict, but not in print, that these were CO white dwarfs, but because of my dithering, this has only come out now, and by now, Josh and his group have already done X-ray identifications or optical X-ray comparisons with these objects and don't find any X-rays. So it's consistent with the fact they're not neutron star companions, rather they are white dwarf companions. I think that was the main point of our paper, right? Oh, the one other cute thing is you can, however, since it came up in passing, if you say it's going to be unstable mass transfer, well, you can still recover the conditions of that applied when it became unstable, because the white dwarf mass still reflects the red giant mass when it first overflowed its Roche slope. And so if you do that, you can work backwards from the white dwarf mass to infer what it was before it underwent, what the separation was before it reached common envelope, or before it entered the common envelope phase, and you infer a separation of about 7 solar radii, which gives you an exchange time of only a few times 10 to the 8 years, roughly comparable to the white dwarf mass now, which says that the Fermi system itself was not a particularly long-lived system. The implication being that this binary has to have gone through at least several epochs, or at least 2, of incarnations of different partners. So there was talk yesterday about how Fred found it so depressing that things had to go through multiple epochs. Well, it certainly seems that this case would definitely have to have gone through several, because even the progenitor system was very short-lived. And that's also consistent, for instance, with one of the systems, was it in 6397, where you have a neutron star and a main sequence star, apparently. People have suggested that was, in fact, something where the neutron star was rejuvenated and then a main sequence star was exchanged in after the fact. Although I believe there are alternative explanations, but these are perfectly consistent. Thank you. Which?
White dwarf, a helium white dwarf, couldn't it just be the core of a giant where either another white dwarf or neutron?
Well, I'm not sure.
There was never a true capture, but the star was destroyed.
Potentially, but you still have to shrink it a bit. Now, so when we discussed this, obviously, and Fred is on the paper, so tidal capture was something that was discussed in loud voices. Well, yes, but as I understand it, an unsuccessful tidal, well, even a successful tidal capture per se, or really a collision, you don't shrink the system that much. It's not really much of a common envelope after the fact, right? Because if you collide a neutron star or a white dwarf and a red giant, you end up with a whatever the guy was, and a helium core white dwarf, in roughly a separation that's not too different from the original impact parameter. And I think that's still fairly susceptible. You've got to take that guy and you've got to shrink him down, like in a common envelope. But if you just whack the guy, most of the material, I think, and I refer you to the man who actually did the simulations. Well, that's not what I understood from what Fred told me.
Look at Rascio and Shapiro 91.
I believe that's the paper we quoted to support the statement I've just made. Yes.
I'd like to return to M4 and mass segregation. The important process here is not so much mass segregation of massive stars concentrating in the core. It's preferential evaporation by the cluster of the very low mass objects. Now, if you look at the mass ranges of these objects today, so I'm going to think loud and you'll correct me if I'm wrong, okay? If you look at the mass range of these objects today, the low mass main sequence stars and the white dwarfs that have been observed, they're very comparable, right? Yeah. They're all a few tenths of a solar mass. So you might think that, therefore, from a dynamical point of view in the cluster, they have behaved exactly in the same way. So in whatever way they were affected by, call it mass segregation or evaporation, the two populations should have been affected in the same way. Then to look at ratios of numbers, like Brad was doing, might actually make sense and constrain directly something about the initial mass merging. But the thing you have to take into account is that most of these white dwarfs you detect there are probably fairly young, because they're the brightest ones. So they haven't been low mass objects for very long in the dynamic of history.
Oh, well, let me take issue with that. The statement most of the white dwarfs are young is not true, because most of them are below that luminosity function jump.
Near the bottom where they accumulate.
So that's not most.
What's the time scale there?
That's a couple of gig years at the jump. And then it telescopes.
But you see the direction I'm taking. I mean, you might explain this and reconcile this with a quote-unquote normal IMF if you were willing to say that the cluster has lost a lot more of its low-mass main sequence stars than it has lost of the low-mass white dwarfs. And of course, the low-mass white dwarfs for some time must have been five-ish solar-mass main sequence stars, and those were, of course, very heavy objects in the cluster. So it actually, at least qualitatively, it goes in the right direction. Whether it can reconcile these numbers of objects with, say, a saltpeter IMF, I don't know.
That would apply maybe to model one that I presented, but to model two, right? Because there I'm doing a mass function like that. So the slope up here in the mass increasing this way, this stuff is presumably not affected by the evaporation because that's all down in here. So the total number of, so remember the X I got from the white dwarf fits is just 0.8 to 8. It's just the distribution of white dwarf progenitors. Now the other stuff I presented was just to make contact with the main sequence, and certainly you get a very consistent number doing this. But yeah, the evaporation would affect this part down here. Now this gets more complicated. I don't think there's much to worry about in terms of screwing up the white dwarf cooling for segregation effects for M4, because it doesn't seem to be much of a binary fraction. 6397 is potentially a much more difficult case, just because that you've got potentially so much more binary production or binaries affecting the actual white dwarf histories. Although that's from Jared's simulations, it doesn't actually appear to be too much of a problem.
Thank you. You emphasized the importance of the initial to final mass relation, and I think it's quite dangerous to try to extrapolate the initial mass function from your data set, because the initial mass function, I mean, the initial final mass relation is quite flat, and then it steepens, and it really depends, it seems to me to depend quite a bit on what the exact shape is.
I'm sorry, I'm not sure where I was extrapolating to the initial mass function.
Weren't you, when you were trying to
extrapolate? Everything I said was really the present day mass function. If I use
the present day mass function, yes.
Well, I mean, when you make a model, you've got to choose several things. So I chose the initial to final mass relation that everybody uses.
It tends to be
uses.
Quite flat. I don't know what everyone means, but it's quite flat initially, and then it steepens quite a bit.
Right. And so I didn't make a plot, but I have used, I did a plot, which I didn't make, which I didn't show, in which I used every initial to final mass relation I could find. The age didn't change. Some of the fits weren't so good. Some of the chi-squares were good. Some of the chi-squares were not.
I'm just making the point, we don't even know that what it is in for.
Well, no, there is some. I mean, it's not well constrained. But there, I mean, you all you can really do is test stellar models.
Sure.
Right,
so.
Roger, we have to stop at this point. Back at 4 o'clock.